Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of the city of brotherly love in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Tonight, episode number 52, we are joined by geographer Andy Merrifield from his home in the UK. We discuss Bill Bungie and the Detroit Geographical Expedition and Institute, the difference between amateurs and professionals walking through southern France with a donkey, and research as pilgrimage. We call episode number 52, Amateur Donkey Expedition. Stay tuned. I want to start unthreading a theme. I think we'll spend some time on this throughout the year. And it's the keyword expedition, a keyword we employ on this show that has its roots in colonial style explorations of the global south or places near to the equator or the poles. I think we think of expedition as being scientific, government sponsored, going off into the corners of the earth or into outer space, perhaps, with the goal of bringing new knowledge back home or finding new resources to fuel economic development. A whole range of, I think, definitions here, all kind of coming back to the apparatus of empire and of growth, of science and progress. And we want to bring on the show tonight a little bit of what's been an influence to this, to our project here. As you may or may not know, we call the whole project the Geographical Imaginations Expedition and Institute, and that's in homage or a tip of the hat to the Detroit Geographical Expedition and Institute, a project taken that took place in the 1960s in Detroit. I want to introduce that a little bit for you tonight. The DGEI, as it's known in short, is really influenced this show, I think, because it subverts the idea that an expedition was reserved for the institutions in this empire and the colonial apparatus. In fact, I think the DGEI really does subvert that and changes not only some of the geographical narratives by including multiple voices, but also provides a real marked shift, something that we can trace back in looking at a shift in how mapping has gone from a very much governmental, technical, institutional practice to then this movement of counter-cartography that challenges that and puts the tools of cartographics in the hands of the many. It democratizes the knowledge and the production, the means of production of the knowledge that comes through in mapping and maps. And it's part of the questions, I think, that brought me to the discipline. So it's really important for me, I think, to talk a little bit about the DGEI. This show, tonight's episode, is not about the DGEI strictly. We're just kind of mentioning it. We'll talk more in the future. We've already talked about it in the past. Episode 18, Pedagogy of the Compressed. We spoke with Rich Hyman and brought some of his ideas to the table about the classroom really as a place for doing geography. So I guess I'd like to introduce just a little bit of background of the DGEI, just for the sake of the listeners, and I'll reference an article found online by the scholar and artist Kanarinka, published on the Civic Media website of MIT, where she's based. And the article is called "The Detroit Geographic Expedition and Institute: A Case Study in Civic Mapping," and she talks about how this was the first expedition mounted by the Society for Human Exploration. And the goal was to join academic geographers with folk geographers and members of the African-American community to use geography to create oughtness maps, maps of how things are and maps of how things ought to be. The expedition's main concern was using geography for social justice, and specifically in Detroit, addressing racial injustice. As Dr. William Bungy wrote in the expedition's first publication, Field Notes 1, "After all, it is not the function of geographers to merely map the earth, but to change it." And I should say, for folk geographer here, Bungy, this was his term, for people who did not have formal training in geographic methods. And so for him, a well-trained academic geographer, he was looking to work with the everyday geographers, the geographers on the streets who recognize and read the spaces that they're talking about, who live in them. And so for him, everyone is a geographer. And so to help us in some ways start off our exploration of the expedition, we have asked Andy Merrifield on the show. Bill Bungy is recently deceased in the last 2 years, and he spent his retirement years or his later career living in Canada, in Quebec. And Andy Merrifield visited him there back in the mid-1990s and had a long conversation with him there about his work and about doing geography. Andy Merrifield's currently an independent scholar. He's the author of more than 12 books and numerous articles, essays, and reviews in The Nation, Harper's Magazine, New Left Review, Adbusters, Brooklyn Rail, Radical Philosophy, and Dissent. His books have been translated into French, German, Dutch, Turkish, Polish, Russian, Chinese, and Korean. He has a doctorate in human geography from the University of Oxford and has spent decades teaching and writing about urbanism, social theory, and literature, both inside and outside of a conventional university setting. He's also published 3 intellectual biographies on Henri Lefebvre, Guy Debord, and John Berger, as well as the popular existential travelogue called The Wisdom of Donkeys. He's a regular speaker at scholarly, literary, and political events on and off campuses. Over the years, he's led somewhat of a nomadic existence, residing in the UK, the US, France, and Brazil. He's tried to live, think, and write, as one of his heroes, James Joyce, once said, in the broadest way imaginable. For an anniversary review on Fitzgerald, A Geography of a Revolution, this is the major book published by William Bungy as a result of the work of the Detroit Geographical Expedition and Institute, Andy Merrifield says the following. "And if anyone should ask if Fitzgerald is a geography classic, we can laugh in their faces. A geographical classic, yes, certainly. But a geography classic with an uppercase disciplinary G? Hardly. For that would be pure hypocrisy, would it not? Given the way Bungy got ousted from the institution, given the way Fitzgerald has been totally ignored by the Academy until this day. It was ignored in its own day, too. Shankman was the only publisher to touch the book with a barge pole. And even then, Bungy had to cough up the dough himself to pay for printing. Fitzgerald is no geography classic. How could it be? Considering the way the discipline has moved in the exact opposite direction to almost everything this book says, to that degree, anyone interested in a career in geography today, as a career as a professional geographer, with tenure, citations, grants, the whole bit, should pass up reading Fitzgerald. It is not a book for you. Should you read it? Should it touch you, inspire you, prompt you to take action? Beware and be warned." Big trouble lies ahead. Andy Merrifield joins us from his home in the UK.
My relationship with Bungie goes back a long time now, but I was trying to think, I think it was 1994 when I went to stay with him in Arthabaska in Quebec in midwinter.
Right.
I think it was February 1994, which is quite a long time ago now. It's 25 years ago, so I still remember it quite well, but some of it is a little bit patchy. But I remember that he came to the bus station to pick me up, and it was in an incredible snowstorm. February in Quebec is quite harsh. So he came out in his car anyway. He was sliding around the road, and he stopped, and he got out the car, and he was a huge guy, so he was instantly recognizable to me, and he was very warm. And then there were some kids who were there, and he asked them whether they needed a ride. So there must have been about, I don't know, half a dozen high school kids who came in the back of the seat and at the back of the car, and I sat in the front, and he just proceeded to talk, you know, just not really talking with me, but talking at me about his work. And the car was sliding around, and he didn't seem to be too bothered about it. But anyhow, we made it back, and it proceeded to snow for, I think, the next 4 days that I was there, so I couldn't really get out of the house. I didn't realize I should have known, but he was something of an insomniac, so he never seemed to go to sleep. I could hear him pacing up and down, and he showed me he had this basement where he had all his files that he told me that they could survive the nuclear explosion if that ever happened.
Oh, wow.
And so I had an interesting four days with him. Very solid, very intense. And getting to know him was a bit difficult because he was really a sort of compulsive obsessive about his work, really. And it was only his dear wife, Donya, who just told him, "Bill, just shut up, you know, stop talking." And he would instantly just stop talking. But I think she was the only one he ever listened to. He didn't listen to anybody else. But it was fascinating seeing all his stuff. And, the guy had been out of academia for years, and yet still he was writing all this stuff, and he had all these things, most of which never got published, most of which were insane. But in amongst the insanity, there was brilliant insights, because the guy was really quite something. And I was always fascinated by the geographical expedition when I started out in academia, and that sort of radical edge of academia, the antipode, the early antipode days in the early 70s, and some of the work on the city, and how the expedition wasn't just about an empire, charting an empire, but maps could be used in ways that could talk about impoverishment and all kinds of inequalities that were happening, not, from the other side of the world, but actually, in downtown Detroit and across America. So the use of maps was really interesting for me.
Yeah.
As a geographer, and how there was a certain kind of partisan objectivity involved. They didn't have to proper property rights or some form of charting the globe for imperialist powers. They could be used to empower the poor, if you want to put it like that. And geography should be something that was speaking, was helping and working alongside, ordinary people in the inner city. And Bill used to have this fantastic thing that, ordinary people have lots of common sense but no sense of scale, whereas scholars and academics have plenty of sense of scale but no common sense. And if you put the two together, we could have some quite productive encounter between the two. And so that was always something that really fascinated me and got me excited about geography as a, as a critical theoretical discipline. And
So his idea of a geographical expedition, I mean, it's different than our common sense way of thinking about, or our everyday way of defining the term expedition. I mean, how do you think we normally define the word expedition? I mean, is it more of a colonial sort of
Yeah, it seems much more superficial, doesn't it? I think much more of a. I think the irony wasn't lost on him. I think it was intentional that, you know, that various geographers would parachute into particular parts of the world and map it out and stake out property rights and discover its mineral resources and look at some of the natural qualities of it, and they would work accordingly. And a lot of it was very much related to questions of power and nationhood and authority, and I think Bill reappropriated that, knowing full well that it was somehow it would provoke, at least provoke some kind of interest, the way he was using it. But I think that, you know, an expedition is just to be somehow much more touristic and much more visiting and much more about just the kinds of things that you could look at as an innocent bystander, as it were, as somehow looking in at something. And I think that, you know, he was much more about some form of rooted anthropology, that, you know, he went to live in inner city Detroit, and he tried to understand what was going on there. So his expedition was much more every day, and it wasn't about, you know, somebody just parachuting in for a week and doing a bit of work there and then some missionary, as it were, and then deciding to, you know, to leave a week or so later. It was a commitment to the area. And I know that when he moved into Fitzgerald, and he did his great book on Fitzgerald in Detroit, yeah, and in the early 70s, well, the late 60s, he would have been there. He probably would have just been out just after the 67 uprising, I think, when he was there, and the book came out in 1971. But one of the ways in which he got entry to the black community there as a big WASPy guy, big white guy.
Yeah.
He was a fantastic jazz pianist, and I think he played in a lot of the bars, and he was a sort of big white dude that got some respect from in the hood, and he got to know this young woman called Gwendolyn Warren, who became something of a soul sister for him, and she was just an ordinary African American woman who just was working in the community there, and he got to know her. And so it was much more of a committed form of geographical expeditions, and much more of a sensitive, intimate sensing rather than a kind of remote sensing, as you might want to call it.
Yeah.
And just getting, you know, and also, you know, the geographer was on the line. It wasn't just zapping in and scooting out. It was the commitment to doing serious geographical work in the community in which you were living, and you were answerable to the people. And, you know, the whole question of representation and who was doing the speaking, who was the teacher, and who was the student were blurred and problematized. And as a young scholar, that was always very interesting for me.
Yeah.
The kinds of things he was doing. So, you know, and I think that there was an ironic spin on the expedition, but it was something much, much, much different from what one would see as a commonsensical idea of what an expedition is and what it still is. You know, and you've got all these things like ecotourism now, and you're going on big expeditions in the rainforest, and, you know, and it lasts for months, and you take great shots, and you upload your YouTube videos, but it was something a little bit different, or a lot different from that. That's probably one way in which I would define it.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. In 2017, Andy Merrifield published The Amateur, a radical manifesto about doing what you love. Merrifield offers a passionate tribute to the revolutionary spirit of the amateur, a figure who thinks outside the box, takes risks, dreams the impossible dream, seeks independence, and carves out a new world. Merrifield celebrates such square pegs as Charles Baudelaire, Fyodor Dostoevsky, Edward Said, Guy Debord, Hannah Arendt, and Jane Jacobs, each of which shows us a path of unconventional wisdom and freedom. The amateur advocates urgently for the liberated life, one that creates the space to question authority.
I was thinking about calling it the unprofessional, but then I alluded to the amateur, and that the amateur was this species that would have resembled much more of a Bill Bungie type, that was not on the payroll of any organization. Their knowledge was not up for hire. They weren't there to make themselves respectable to the powers that be. They were there to rock the boat, to be critical about what was going on. And that they were much more multidisciplinary in the way they looked at things and weren't narrow. One of the things about being a professional is you have to be an expert. You're an expert. You have a very low, very concentrated remit. Your intellectual curiosity and the vista of your intellectual landscape is quite narrow because you're trying to keep it together and keep it focused to keep it within the remit of your expertise. And so therefore, you know, the whole question of specialization was seemed to be killing your sense of any kind of excitement or intellectual discovery or sense of being curious, and I just wanted to come up with something about the antithesis, the nemesis of the professional, and this was a sort of archetype, a normative ideal, and I think subsequently people have let me know that they were. You know, they agree with it and see themselves as amateur people who are not moved by profit or reward, but a love for something and a real unquenchable interest in seeing connections across lines and barriers and not being tied down to a specialty and caring for ideas and a value system that was not restricted by a profession, and so for me, the amateur was a sensibility about how one operated in the world and an allegiance that it wasn't tied to power and ambition and wealth and making yourself marketable, but it was actually somehow completely anti that. And so Bungie would fit the bill. Unfortunately, I don't think there were a lot of amateurs about today. But I do think that some professionals do have amateur sensibilities that don't nudge. So I did want to blur the distinction a bit because I know that it's not just somebody necessarily outside of an institution that can be an amateur. If my idea was that amateurism is a sensibility and allegiance, then there's perhaps ways in which amateurs can still wear suits and ties and work for organizations. But it's just about what your allegiances are for and whether you want to be somebody who's propping up the status quo or whether somebody who's a bit critical about things. I think there's a sense in which it is possible. So I didn't want to just suggest that everybody had to be outside of academia or quit academia as I had done or be outside of an institution, be somehow an amateur. It's just an outsider. An amateur can be an insider, but it's a question of what they do with that insider status. You know, somebody like Bill Bungie was a PhD in geography and a professional, as it were, in terms of his resume, but he decided to do something with it and tilt it and aim it and follow a different trajectory in terms of how he used that knowledge and what this knowledge could do. And so that's probably a little bit how I would I was trying to see it in the book. The book came across maybe a little bit cruder than it should have been, but as a provocation, I was relatively content with what it was trying to say.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition. With a search for slowness and tranquility in mind, Andy Merrifield set out on a journey of the soul with Gribouille, a friend's donkey, to walk for days amid the ruins and spectacular vistas of Haute Auvergne in southern France. While Merrifield contemplates literature, science, truth, and beauty, Gribouille surprises him with his subtle wisdom, reminding him time and again that enlightenment is all around us if we but seek for it. One of over a dozen books written by Merrifield, The Wisdom of Donkeys reminds us that observing, being mindful, and living in the moment are essential to leading a fulfilled life.
It was just an idea that came to me when I was we went to Marrakesh in Morocco. I was just on a sort of vacation. My wife was at the meetings we had there, and I just was looking at these donkeys. They were traveling, carrying all the, pretty much everything that was part of everyday life in Morocco, from food to TVs to refrigerators, you know. And there were Mercedes whizzing around with the tourists. Everyday life in Marrakesh was pretty much the mode of transport and the mode that was, you know, keeping it afloat were donkeys, and a lot of them were very badly treated. And I just looked, and I just started to read. And suddenly, I found that George Orwell had written about donkeys, and then, of course, then about Marrakesh, because he was there for trying to get his health back into shape with his problems with his lungs, his TB, And so I read some of the things that Orwell said, and then I remembered that Orwell wrote Animal Farm, and then I looked at Animal Farm again, and it turned out the old Benjamin was the old donkey in Animal Farm was actually the wisest of all the characters.
Right.
Slightly cynical character, but old Benjamin was the real sage. You knew exactly what was going on within on the farm, and some of the other animals were quite naive about what was happening there, and so I just got intrigued then about this, and thought I could write some kind of parable, as it were, you know, that the world was obsessed with new technology and donkeys were very low tech. The world was very, very warlike right then, with the Iraqi war was in full flight. And donkeys, by nature, are very peaceable. People were being pushed around to do this and to sell themselves to some, you know, to some career path and you know, donkeys took no shit from anybody. You can't pull a donkey if they don't want to go. It's impossible. You can't push them. You can't pull them. They're quite stubborn. They do what they want. And the world was going faster and faster, and obsessed with speed and things like that. And the donkey was this very slow creature that did things in its own time. So I just wanted to write something on a donkey and include some of these ingredients that were gentle critique of contemporary values and politics and society.
Yeah.
And then I had the idea, well, I could try and write it through the lenses of a donkey. Then I thought, well, I had to get to know about donkeys. So then I spent some time with people who knew about donkeys, and even things like donkey psychiatrists and donkey shrinks. And I went to various organizations. I even went to Egypt to watch vets in action. And I went to Mexico to see the vets there and donkey vets out in the Mexican countryside, and the narrative. Then I just needed some way to structure it. So then I thought, well, I know about the French countryside, so why don't I just take a walk with one and then Robert Louis Stevenson came into the play a little bit, because he'd also used the idea of walking with a donkey in the French countryside as a form of therapy and a form of just self-reflection and a little bit of taking stock and thinking about stuff, going slowly. And so I wanted to do that. To some degree, it was a midlife crisis, maybe pushing it, but there was probably something involved in that. So there was a whole host of different things that were going through, from the personal to the political.
Yeah.
And then I just wanted to write something about that. So when I did the walk with a donkey, which I was walking for a couple of weeks in an area which I knew, then it was just a question of trying to write it all up. And it was a fun book. It was very memorable doing the book, and the book that, you know, remains very important to me.
Yeah.
Even though it seems quite antithetical and slightly out of sync with some of my other work, I don't necessarily see that. I remember when it was translated into French, when I was still living in France then, that it got published in France with a better publisher, really, than it did in the UK, in the US, at least a better known publisher, a much more prominent publisher. And I did quite a lot of things on the radio, and I remember going on French radio a couple of times, and the questions they were asked me were very much couched in the philosophy of it, and they were very interested in the stuff on Guy Debord, because I had made some allusions to Guy Debord and Gaston Bachelard and various French philosophers, and some Nouvelle Vague movies were in the book, if you remember, as Robert Bresson, and so the questions became much more around those. So in a way, they were fleshing out areas of the book that were much more in keeping with the kinds of things I've done in the past. So in other words, the book was not much of a detour on my intellectual path. It was very much, you know, still keeping it going. So that was nice, because I hadn't thought about that myself very much. It was pointed out to me, and that was nice. And to some degree, my talking to you now is also, you've spotted some of this continuity, if you like, rather than a discontinuity, that there are some connections involved in what I've done. So that is something that authors cannot often see themselves.
Right. I mean, do you think of yourself, especially that particular book, but maybe in other work as well, do you see yourself as an essayist? And let me just quickly say, I guess in seeing even the critical introduction to Henri Lefebvre, connecting personal anecdote and kind of giving us just a different texture and seeing some biographical context through which, you know, some of his theoretical frameworks emerged. You know, do you see yourself as not doing academic writing, but writing essays? Is that something?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair comment. In terms of, I tend to write shorter books, and they've never been definitive statements. They've never been, you know, poems that said everything about everything, and, you know, 500 pages and definitive works about some topics. It tended to be a little bit more episodic and a little bit more playful and open-ended, I like to think. And I never want to write the same book twice.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to sort of slightly not build up some kind of system, but just to keep meandering and maybe not be a predictable writer, writing about things which aren't predictable, and, you know, just something that really is a bit off-center. And so I suppose I have purposely done that, not written the same book twice, although, you know, there were certain repetitions in some of them, but they've been, I like to think of them being related, but actually different in themselves from other books that I've done. And so an essayist is, I do like the essay, and I'm a big reader of short stories, and it's very much came out in the latest book I did, What We Talk About When We Talk About Cities and Love, is, you know, particularly around the work of Raymond Carver, and I realised that actually a lot of my my literary loves are short stories and short story writers, when there's a certain way in which you need to condense things and the reader is also part of the short story, because you can't say everything about everything, and you can show rather than tell.
Yeah.
So they, sometimes, you know, when I was doing the Omnibus Fair book, for example, I didn't want to write a biography that started, you know, when he was a kid and finished when he was an old guy. I wanted to just do it in a different way, so I decided to do it thematically, and that was the structure of the book, and be a bit playful around it, and then introduce myself into it, so you weren't going to get something which was a distant take on it. It was going to be something that was partisan, and I was somehow involved in it, and I just felt that it could humanize the person and
yeah.
the attraction I had for the person, and my bet was that a lot of people, you know, feel the same way, that this wasn't just dry scholarship, it was something that the stakes were higher, and I was identifying with the person for a good reason, politically and psychologically and personally, and there's a reason why I wanted to write about him, which isn't to say that it was going to, you know, it was just going to be some hagiography. It was something that was, you know, critical, and the idea of the critical introduction was that it wasn't critical in the sense of being condemning. It was being critical in the sense that this was absolutely essential right now. So the introduction, the critical introduction, was necessary at a critical point in time.
Yeah.
So that was the play with it, because the publisher was quite adamant they wanted it to be that. So again, it was me who came up with it, the idea of wanting to do the book, but they were adamant they wanted it to be a primer. But I just didn't want it to be a textbook. I wanted it to be something a bit different. So I played around with that. And the original proposal I did for the book, I sent off to a few agents. I mean, there was an agent I had who placed the book, who was a Californian woman, who said that she really liked the idea of donkeys, but she thought the most powerful writing was when I was talking about myself, which came as a surprise, I think, because I was always a little bit tentative about writing myself, and I didn't want to write about myself as the subject. I was the narrator, but then I realized, luckily, the narrator shouldn't be somehow sitting on the fence. Let's put the narrator in it, and
right.
Visible, and warts and all, if you like. And so I did it, followed what she had to say, and it seemed like it worked quite well. And then since then, I've always peppered a little thing and salted my books with little personal anecdotes, and you know, I just wanted to let people know that there's a narrator here who's here, you know, and he's taking part in it and shaping what you're reading, and he's not innocent in what I'm saying, you know, and so that was what I wanted to do with the biographies, and Guy Debord has really, really very much shaped my thinking, even to the point of getting out of academia, that I could not talk about somehow my relationship with him. And
you're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program, or radio essay expedition, that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrik in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
When you go to, when you're including these the biographies in your writing, and if we're going to call it the essays here, and putting together these essays, and when you're making these trips to the birthplace of Henri Lefebvre or places where they lived, maybe the building in Paris where he wrote A View from the Window in Rhythm Analysis. Are these pilgrimages to you?
it's a good question, Kevin.
Yeah.
Sort of, I would say. Yeah, I don't know. I can't believe that I'm alone, but I do have this strange fascination with seeing where people live.
Yeah.
And just a sense of what makes them tick, I was very struck when I first went to see where Guy Debord used to live in very rural France, and that was a big moment for me when I discovered the house, and I built a whole life form around that that went on for a number of years to the point that I eventually bought a house, about 45 minutes away from his house. It still is, because Alice's window is still there, so I don't know her personally, I just saw her around at local markets, introduced myself again. So I interviewed her in 2003 for that book, and the Dieter Bohr book.
Yeah.
So, the pilgrimages, it's always been my wife said, in fact, recently she said, I kind of miss not doing these things, and part of the problem now is that a lot of the people that I'm writing about, I've written about, and some of the others are dead or it's long gone.
Right.
The last person did a little pilgrimage about was John Berger, and I wrote a book about John Berger, who incidentally really is fits the bill as an editor.
Right.
The art critic and the poet and writer and novelist John Berger.
Sure.
As Bill Bundy is really, and I remember first going to see where he lived, and suddenly it was quite an amusing thing in the Haute Savoie, near Geneva in the French Alps, that I tried to find out which house he lived in. This is before I actually got to know him later on, personally, I remember my wife and I were doing a walk in the idyllic French countryside in the Alps, Mont Blanc in the distance, and it was gorgeous, and I asked somebody about the English writer, and they knew where he lived, and they pointed out the house. So and as we walked past there, he was in the garden fiddling around with something, and he turned around and waved and said bonjour. It was hilarious, and my wife said, go up and say something to him. I said, no, I can't go up and bother him on a Sunday. I think it was a Sunday afternoon, he probably just had lunch or something.
Right.
I just didn't have the guts to bother him, So I ended up waving, and we quickly scuttled away, So it was quite funny, really. He just seemed like this old grandfatherly figure was very genial to people who were stalking him, So it was quite funny. So
yeah.
they've always been adventures that have always, somehow had a deep place content. The sense of place has been...
Yeah.
Involved in it somehow, the text in this place, the smell of place, what it is, what it's like,
place
what
shapes
it feel
us.
Like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
places shaping the intellect, the...
That's right. So even down to these smells, I mean, you know, I just think that they're important. And I know that, you read this, something like probably the greatest biographer that's ever lived, and like Robert Caro, who did the Lyndon B. Johnson biographies recently, and I think the final one is Waiting, and I mean, he did the huge tome on Robert Moses.
Yeah.
And he talks about the work of a biographer. But he's I mean, how he becomes obsessed with the character, but he talks about, you know, he went to live in Texas for a while, and this is, a Jewish New Yorker brought up in the Bronx, so him going to Texas to live in open spaces was quite a big thing, but he felt that he had to get to know the lay of the land to figure out what made, you know, L.B. Johnson tick here, you know, and he doesn't bring himself into the narrative, but he, I could relate to on a much more modest level and scale what he was talking about when he was writing about the idea that he had to locate himself in their space, you know, and find out what made them tick, you know, somehow. Yeah.
Is it their geographical imagination?
The context was, somehow was not innocent in who they were as people, you know, and how they grew up and what made them tick. I felt that very deeply in some of the things that I've written that I needed to get intimate.
So is it you unpacking your geographical imagination, since it's been informed by Debord and Lefebvre and Bachelard?
And trying to get a sense of
their geographical imagination?
Trying to get a sense of theirs. And a lot of people that know me have always said that when I write a book about somebody, it's a book about me. It does sound very self-indulgent, I know. And it's clearly, they're clearly right and they're clearly wrong. Right in the sense, obviously, I'm attracted to something, and when I left academia, I just wanted to write about people that I love, things that I love. You know, Guy Debord has a wonderful line in Panegyric, which is a very thin autobiography that he wrote, and he said, "My method will be very simple. I'm going to tell you about what I love," and that's somebody who was very critical about the world and about life. So it's quite a revelation to read him say that. And then I thought, well, I don't have to be scholarly in the sense that on the one hand this, on the other hand that, and find both and be critical. I could write about things that I love. So I decided that I wanted to write about people I identified with.
Yeah.
And there was a reason. And by working through their work, I could find exactly what it was that I was identified to, and it became a form of just expressing some of my things. And my essays do merge between writing about other people through my lenses, and I'm making them work for me in a way. So they're probably not the most objective studies of these people.
Right.
But then, on the other hand, you find insights that you weren't sure about them and about you. And, you know, and other times I just want to write about things that interest me. And I just think by nature, it's always going to involve engaging with other people's work and using them. Because, just writing about yourself isn't so interesting, really, general. It needs to be contextualized within some reason why.
Well, there you have it. Andy Merrifield from the UK joining us to discuss The Expedition, The Amateur, Walking with Donkeys, and Pilgrimage here to the sites of different scholars that he's researched, a very biographical approach to doing research, something I think we here do on the show. You know, we've spoken with Yifu Tuan, Doreen Massey, Veronica Della Dora, amongst others who've come on the show. We've discussed J.K. Wright, long deceased, but through people that have met him. I think in some ways we're playing the game, the degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon, maybe here the degrees of separation from people like Henri Lefebvre, who've shaped not only the discipline of geography, capital G there, but I think my own thinking. And as Andy Merrifield is saying, a lot of times he ends up writing and inserting himself more than he ever thought comfortable, or more than he ever was comfortable with as an academic. He's inserting himself in these personal essays, if you will, and situating himself in there, as I think is only proper. We use our lenses and our frameworks, our geographical imagination, when we do our research, the kinds of questions we ask, but then also what we're making public comes through our lens, and our own thinking is shaped by that. And so we too are making a pilgrimage here, I think, by having Andy Merrifield on the show. I'll have to look him up in the UK at some point, and I will let everyone know his address so that we can find him. Just kidding, Andy. But through him, we found out more about Henri Lefebvre, Bill Bunge, and Guy Debord. And we thank Andy for sharing with us a wide range of ideas and discussing with us on our show, Geographical Imaginations, where ultimately, yes, it does come back to us, to me here. This is a collective geographical imagination that we're looking at, but I think undoubtedly I'm choosing topics that interest me and that have framed some of my thinking and fueled some of my thinking. And I thank Andy for being a participant, a collaborator, if you will, here on the show. And look forward to our further commitment to finding out more, this keyword expedition, and digging into what it means to be on expedition, what it means to be doing geography, what it means to be an everyday geographer. Thanks to Mike Allen for his song here, and look forward in the next episodes as we start to explore the Arctic, terra incognita for us on the show. See ya. Bye. Thanks.